first two on the agenda.
Good morning. I'd like to convene the House Committee on Business and Labor Wednesday, April 1st.
What day is that?
And with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2090 and House Bill 3471.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2090 establishes a task force that would investigate the relationship between large employers and the employees receiving public assistance and to make recommendations regarding possible imposition of a fee on large employers to offset public assistance expenses. Requires the recommendations to be submitted by March 1 of 2016. Declares an emergency. There are no amendments on that measure, and there is a referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. House Bill 3471 imposes a fee on certain large employers for each employee paid less than a specified amount, and it grants BOLI the authority to administer and enforce the fee collection, provides for an appeal process, requires large employers to keep records of relevant wage and hour information, creates an advisory council on the employment-related public benefit fee, permits appropriations of funds generated by the fee to DHS for the purpose of employment-related daycare program and Medicaid. There are no amendments before you, and there is a request that the bill be referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you. So let's call up Representative Ann Leininger.
Hey.
Magic. Good morning, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Ann Leininger. I represent Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland. And I'm here today because yesterday on the House floor, we had a lot of intense conversation about how important it is to make tough decisions and to prioritize spending for K through 12 education and to look at all the other expenditures we make and see if they make sense. I'm here in support of House Bill 3471 and the ideas that underpin it because, according to some research, we spend about $1.7 billion a year on services to support working people who, even though they're working, can't earn enough to make ends meet and get the housing and the health care and the food and things that they need. And I think that money can rightly be thought of as essentially a subsidy to the employers with whom these folks are working, who are running profitable businesses but are paying these workers so little that the workers need to come to us, other taxpayers, the state, to get the help they need to make ends meet. And I don't think that makes sense. And I don't think that's a sensible way for us to use $1.7 billion that could be spent on core services like education and public safety and other safety net social service needs. And so I support the idea that we look at a public benefit fee so that some of these employers that are paying poverty-level wages can internalize the costs that their business model is creating for the rest of us. My colleagues here are going to give you much more in-depth description of the bill and answer technical questions, but I wanted to be here to note the particular relevance of this bill on a day right after we approved a school K through 12 budget that a lot of us would like to augment. Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate your introduction. Representative Kinnemer, a question?
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm intrigued. You call it a public benefit fee, but from a practical perspective, I think it would be a tax and subject to a tax vote.
So, Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemer, I appreciate that question. I know that people have a difference of opinion about the appropriate characterization of the fee, as I refer to it.
yeah.
And I'm going to defer to my colleagues who are here to answer technical questions to forward with that. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Widener has a question.
Good morning. Sorry, Representative Weidner. It's your bill, so I just wanted to see, I mean, you kind of gave us a little bit of an overview of where it came forward, but I noticed it seems like it's focusing on large employers and not really looking at all of it, because a lot of You know, you get into the wine industry, you get into small retail shops. A lot of these are low-skill employment opportunities as well, where some of the people are at where they're getting benefited and they're not full-time. Some of them are part-time. Wondering why it looks like you're just singling out large employers in the state rather than taking a sample of some of the small employers, and I'm just kind of curious why you did that with this rather than actually taking a true scope of really what's going on and where all the benefits are coming from, because this will be from lots of small businesses, I think we'll find as well, because they're just barely getting by and they're looking at ways to just stay afloat lots of times.
So, Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, thank you for that question. You're right, it does focus on employers with more than 250 employees. My impression of the situation is that there is a particular class of employers that have the resources to pay workers more, that may be above 250 employers, maybe radically above 250 employees. They may be companies that operate all over the country and all over the world with very successful business models that happen to entail paying workers wages at such a low level that those workers must rely on the rest of us taxpayers to subsidize their cost of living. And so that is why we chose that. And again, I'm going to ask that you save some of your juiciest questions for me.
Well, now that
asking me questions, and I can keep saying that.
I recognize you perhaps have another committee to go to.
And I'm actually going to go meet with the governor to talk about marijuana.
So
we will leave that alone.
Juicy question. One of those meetings, yeah.
She does have a meeting with the governor. And
that's just one quick one.
Okay. Representative Barreto, it is a quick question,
you,
so
Mr.
we expect a quick answer.
Yeah, the question is just the $1.7 billion, is that state and federal assistance?
You know, my understanding, and my friend Daniel Morris here, who's eager to answer all kinds of questions that you may have, can tell you more about it, but my understanding is that it's state.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, and appreciate your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Okay, you too.
Up next, let's have Daniel
Morris.
Stacy Cowan and Heather Conroy.
Yeah, Heather didn't make it. She's stuck in traffic.
Okay, let's not have Heather.
Christy
Palmer.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Good morning. I'm Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm the research director for Our Oregon. Our Oregon represents organizations and individuals that care about lots of different things, from investing in education to protecting the environment to helping our economy grow. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3471, which we just heard would impose a fee on large employers of low-wage workers to help offset the costs of providing that public assistance to their workforce. So many Oregonians work for low wages. Over 500,000 adults earn less than $15 an hour, and over a quarter of the workforce earns less than $12 an hour. That's over 400,000 people. And a large share of these low-wage workers are employed by large employers. So based on recent data from the Oregon Employment Department, I estimate that around 37% of all the jobs that pay less than $10 or $15 an hour are for companies that have more than 250 employees. So it's really these large employers employ a kind of a disproportionate number of the low-wage workers. And as we just heard from Representative Leininger, that you know many people are working for such low wages and getting so few hours that they do end up needing public assistance. And as Representative Leininger said, you know based on a study of looking at 197,000 working Oregonians who were receiving food assistance through the SNAP program. We estimate that the overall annual cost of providing food assistance, medical, and child care support exceeds $1.7 billion per year. I did just want to make one correction, that number does include both state and federal dollars. I think that is important to note. So, many of these programs, like SNAP, for instance, is the kind of the primary one where the funds are the benefits are federal dollars that are paid out. The state shares the administration of those fees. So even though all the funds come from taxpayers because we pay our federal taxes in addition to our state taxes, those if you were to able to raise everyone's wages to get them, priced out of those programs, the savings wouldn't all necessarily accrue to the general fund. So I do want to make that clear. So while taxpayers are picking up the tab for this really massive amount of public assistance, some of the big corporations that rely on these low-wage part-time workers, many of them really are racking up some pretty healthy profits. The example I like to use is that there's a study that estimates that nationally, public assistance just to Walmart workers across the country exceeds $6 billion a year. And when you compare that to the Walmart's reported profits last year of $16 billion, it's hard to put those numbers next to each other, and at least for me, and to not think that represents a pretty massive subsidy for a major profitable corporation, one of the most profitable in the world. So, of course, to make matters worse, Oregon has the lowest effective business taxes in the country, which means that we don't have the revenues that we need to actually provide assistance to everyone who needs it. So I think the clever thing about House Bill 3471 is that it offers a way to get these big employers to chip in a little bit more to help offset the costs of providing public assistance to their low-wage workforce. And so I just like to thank you for your consideration of this bill, and I urge your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Can we go ahead and listen to the rest of the panel and then ask our questions?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Stacey Cowan. I'm with SEIU Local 503. We represent 55,000 Oregonians doing 500 different jobs in 85 state, local government, nonprofit agencies, and care provider facilities. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3471. I'd like to walk through sort of the components of the bill and just to talk to you a little bit about our intentions behind the policy. So I'll start by saying that we've worked really hard on this bill for several months, for a long time, and I will just say that the bill's not perfect. But really, our goal is to disincentivize large corporations from creating a business model that relies on Oregon taxpayers to subsidize a low-wage workforce. That was the working goal that we had with this policy. House Bill 3471 creates the employment-related public benefit fee. The fee is meant to offset a portion of the actual cost incurred by the state to administer state programs such as the Oregon Health Plan, employment-related daycare. The funding for the fee will be used to support and improve access to quality, affordable health care and child care for working families. It's well documented that increasing access to state-funded programs like health care and child care reduces absenteeism among workers. It increases employee productivity, and it helps boost workforce morale. House Bill 3471 requires companies with more than 250 Oregon employees to pay an hourly-based fee of 50 cents for every worker earning $11 an hour or less, or 120% of the state minimum wage rate. We arrived at the 50 cent fee by first looking at the average cost of providing assistance to low wage workers. This fee really represents a minimal fee compared to what it actually costs to provide assistance to these low wage workers. It really is a starting point, and it's designed to not be overly burdensome on employers, but at the same time, again, really trying to disincentivize this type of business model. We arrived at the $11 an hour threshold by looking at the average wage of workers who receive benefits. Daniel mentioned this. The $11 an hour really is the bare minimum. We know that there are folks that make more than $11 an hour that are having difficult time making ends meet. However, we felt that by setting this low bar, we actually still capture a large number of workers. Again, Daniel mentioned the number of workers that would be impacted by this legislation. Just to repeat a couple of points there.
that Daniel made. In January of 2014, the Employment Department reported that there were 394,000 jobs that paid less than $11 an hour. 37% of those were with large employers, so that represents about 146,000 jobs. During that same time frame, the average hourly wage for workers receiving SNAP benefits was $12.36 an hour. So the intention is that this fee would be set into a separate and distinct fund that's separate from the general fund. The money raised would be used to reimburse the cost of supporting the OHP, the Oregon Health Plan, and the ERDC, employment-related daycare. Additionally, House Bill 3471 establishes an advisory council made up of employers and workers who deliver services and workers that receive services. The council would be responsible for advising how to use the money generated by the fee, but to also make policy recommendations regarding usage of state assistance by low-wage workers and to really be able to have a place to have that conversation about what that impact looks like. We really believe that this is an important conversation that needs to be had. Large corporations should not be allowed to profit off of low-wage workers, why Oregon taxpayers foot the bill. With that, I'll go ahead and close. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Christine Palmer, and I'm proud to say that I am an early childhood educator who for the past 18 years has provided education and holistic care to children in the most critical formative years of their development. I've worked in a variety of settings for the past 18 years, both small and large businesses, and I'm a member of SEIU, Local 503, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3471. Now, while the bill will not impact me currently or my employer, I wanted to be here today to talk about the impact of being a low-wage worker and to also share the story of other workers like me. For the bulk of my career, though, I did work for businesses that benefited financially from my low wages. For years, I worked long hours. At times, I juggled two, even three jobs just to make ends meet. And now, after two decades of long days teaching and long evenings doing homework, I earn a whopping $13.82 an hour. And I'm one of the lucky ones. Many of my colleagues in a similar profession earn anywhere from nine-something, $10 to $12 an hour. And frankly, obviously, that's just not enough to make it on their own. Like many coworkers, at times, I've also had to rely on state assistance. And frankly, this felt degrading, and it frankly seemed inefficient. My coworkers and I often say, gee, if we were just paid a living wage, what would that look like? Growing up, I lived in modest mobile homes in rural Oregon and Idaho, and I often dreamed, even from the time I was a little girl, of working with young children. That's been a dream of mine my whole life. And I earned a college degree, and I fulfilled that dream of becoming a teacher for young children. Sadly, the American dream that I often heard about in my youth still proves to be elusive for myself and most of my colleagues. My fellow teachers and I are not proud when we apply for food assistance or forbearance or a myriad of other programs. We don't want to be dependents. We work really hard, and we feel that we should be able to stand on our own two feet. Those were values that I grew up with in rural Oregon and Idaho. None of us want to be a burden on our fellow taxpayers. There's a woman named Susan who couldn't be here today, but asked that I share a few words about her story as well. And it's not much different than mine. She has a bachelor's degree in elementary education, and she recalls also working two or three part-time jobs plus a full-time job to make enough money to get by. She's had to apply for food stamps and juggle money as she's tried to decide to pay which bill which day, and has even had to ask her local churches to help her pay her utilities, just because there's never enough money to make all the bills at the same time. This bill's important because it's allowed me to be here to share my story and stories like Susan's, because policymakers like you really need to know, I think, the impacts of being a low-wage worker and what it's like, you know, what it's really like to have to rely on state assistance. We shouldn't incentivize large, profitable corporations' reliance on a low-wage workforce. And Oregon taxpayers, we don't think, should foot the bill. Each and every day, I'm a teacher, and I teach children how to be good citizens. I teach them not to be greedy and to be kind and to share our classroom resources, which are limited, in an equitable manner. The spirit of this bill, I really do think, aligns with these values. And as I was writing my testimony, I thought of Ben, one of my students, who's delightful, who's 5 years old. And I thought, what would he say? And I think he would say, well, actually, he says this every day. He says, think about what's most fair and what's most kind before you act. I urge you all to think about Ben's words and my story and the story of Susan and others like me as you consider this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morris, or Dr. Morris, I was intrigued by your discussion about 37% of the employers being in the 250, and I guess I'm trying to understand that. I presume, perhaps, for example, that a franchise, McDonald's, is one of these employers, even though they're individually owned.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemer, thank you for that question. So I don't know if I have a if I know the exact answer to this question. Let me just tell you where the data come from, and then this may actually be a better question to ask folks of the Oregon Employment Department. But basically, the way that they report the data, they have a program called the Quarterly Census of Employment and Wages, which is related to unemployment insurance collections, and basically those collections are. They come in kind of at the business, at the they call it the reporting unit, the actual business location. But then those business locations are kind of rolled up into firm level. So if someone owns, say, 5 McDonald's stores, I think that there might be like each store might be reported separately, but then the 5 would be reported together. So I'm not exactly sure how they treat overall the franchises. What I know from the tables is that when in that category that says of firms, employers that have more than 250 employees, that they cover 37% of the workers who make less than $15 or $10 or $12 an hour. So that's the that's what I know from the data. I know there are some. There was, I believe, a National Labor Relations Board ruling recently that McDonald's is the corporate McDonald's is a should be treated as a joint employer of workers in the franchises. I don't actually know how that kind of the implications for the data that are reported at the Oregon Employment Department. It's something I'd be happy to look into more, encourage you to ask specifically. To the Employment Department.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Yeah. You threw out a number of $16 billion in profits from Walmart. Do you know what their gross sales are?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I don't know that off the top of my head, but I can...
$485 billion. So they would be making a 3.3% profit margin on that. If you took out the $6 billion that you say go to benefits, they would then make $10 billion in profits, and that would leave them a 2% profit margin. If I went to the bank and said, gee, I'd like to start up a business, and I plan on making a 2% profit margin, I don't think they would go for that. May I follow up with that?
Follow up.
Part of that is, you know, as I see these bills coming through, it seems that government wants to get more and more into dictating what businesses can and what they can't do and how much profit they should or shouldn't make. You know, Walmart is the largest public traded company in the world. people invest in these companies, you know, so that they can get a return on their investment and put away for their retirement too. I understand the issue here, but it seems like a backwards way of going about getting the wages up. Can I make one more comment?
Follow up.
The other thing is, many low-income people enjoy shopping at Walmart because they have some of the lowest prices too. And when you start raising the income of the employees, they have to raise the price of their goods too. And so it is kind of a catch-22 issue. But to me, the issue really comes down to, should the government be telling what private business what they should or shouldn't be paying their employees?
And Representative Brito, thank you for those comments and questions. I appreciate them. So let me, I'd be happy to answer just a few responses, and hopefully I'll cover everything. So, so first, with regards to the profits that Walmart are making, it's true there are many shareholders in Walmart, but most of the dividends go to just four people that own the majority of the Walmart stock. Those are the Walmart shares. And so while it's true that there are many shareholders that share in those profits, most of them just go to, you could count them on one hand, right? So I guess I tend not to think of that as a compelling argument for why they couldn't that corporation couldn't afford to pay their workers slightly more. I also don't think that when we're talking about the very small marginal change in payroll costs for a company like Walmart, that I would suspect that they'd be able to maintain their current profit margin without noticeably changing their prices. So I guess I don't see a bill like 3471 as a very burdensome on them. And then the other point I just wanted to respond to is that you're right, the Walmart workers, many of them do shop at Walmart. There's other interesting research that finds that Walmart's one of the kind of the primary recipients of sort of SNAP spending, of food stamp spending. But even in their recent financial reports, they've noted that that sales are not as good as they could be because their sort of target market actually doesn't have enough money in their pocket to spend as much as otherwise they would if they were making higher wages. So I think that even by even kind of by that standard, that being able to raise wages kind of across the board actually benefits these large employers as well.
Can I follow up on that? Please.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Walmart's target market is anyone who has any money. I mean, their target market is not low-income people. I'm sorry, but it's everyone, you know. They don't discriminate and say, or they don't target and say, we just want to get the low-income people. They say, no, we want to sell to everyone out there in the world. That's how they became the biggest.
So, Chair Holby, Representative Brito, thank you for that comment. I think there's probably some stuff I could dig up for you around the actual target, around the actual market demographics of of Walmart shoppers that may shed some more light on that. So thank you. I'd be happy to provide that to you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just try and steer it back here a little bit. Most companies, when they have a certain profit margin that they're looking at. I actually know this because I have a business and everything, and we look at profit margins. So we figure our labor cost, everything into that, and then we set accordingly. So whether it's 40%, 50%, 10%, 5%, you look at all your costs and you adjust that. So if we start increasing or telling businesses how much they should be paying or what they should be doing for some of these jobs, we're kind of opening Pandora's box a little bit, aren't we, to drive up the cost of goods across the state compared to other states, or keep other companies from locating here to actually put people to work? Are we not, if we go through and start dictating or telling the business how much they should be paying above what our state minimum wage is?
I would just say, Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, thank you for the comment.
It's a question.
Thank you. Our goal really was, again, to just disincentivize these large corporations. We were really trying to get at corporations that build a business model based on a low-wage workforce. That was our objective. I think that we know that exists, and so that's really what we were trying to get at with the language. I think that, you know, again, I mentioned the bill's not perfect. I think we're open to ideas if folks feel that there are other ways at getting at the issue. We just recognize that the problem exists, and this was our attempt at fixing that.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to think, how are we going to figure out how Walmart employees are on Medicaid and everything? Because wouldn't it be illegal for Walmart to be asking their employees if they're on this, or if they're offering subsidies or signing their employees up for these benefits? Because lots of times it's us. We have different groups that are out there going out and signing people up for these benefits. We have lots of people that are receiving benefits sometimes that really aren't needing the benefits. With some of the different statistics. So I'm just wondering, I keep hearing Walmart. There's a lot more than Walmart out there. There's McDonald's, there's Burger King, I have no idea what all companies you're looking at, but 30% of the employers in Oregon, or 37%, whatever number you quoted, but that's a large amount of employers. And I'm listening to a lot of these are entry-level jobs that are coming into. I worked at Kmart when I was in high school and right out of high school, and guess what? I wanted to make more money, so I left Kmart right after I'd graduated and went and started working on a farm and then in the woods for family so I could make. At that point, it was $15 an hour rather than, I think we were $5 an hour minimum wage. So I see them kind of as entry-level or starting jobs to move us into other industries. And I don't think we want to lose those, do we?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener. So let me answer. So I heard two questions.
First, the Medicaid. There's two.
So first, Walmart doesn't, or these employers don't necessarily know which of their employees are receiving assistance. The state actually does know. Oregon actually is invested in a really fantastic data system to track the recipients of all manner of safety net programs, SNAP, OHP, ERDC, all these programs are tracked in this system. And those data are linked to people's employment records. So we can actually get out of the state folks in the state could tell you those data are available for analysis. In 2007, the Department of Human Services actually produced a report for the legislature listing the top employers of workers who are receiving SNAP. And if you haven't seen a copy of that, I'd be happy to submit a copy to the committee for you to see. Even though recently they, I know actually Representative Nose's office requested those data, and they were not. The agency declined to provide them, but that's actually something that could be done through legislative action to actually get the agency to disclose those data, so you could actually see specifically where people who are receiving assistance were working, and I think that'd be great to be able to actually see the real numbers. In the high cost of low wages report, we looked at aggregate statistics at the industry level. So even though we can say we saw that there were 13,000 workers receiving SNAP who worked at fast food restaurants. We couldn't tell you how many worked at McDonald's versus Burger King versus Subway and so forth. But those data should be available somewhere in the system, and we could figure that out. And then just to your other question around sort of the entry-level jobs, I think you're right that it used to be the case that these low-wage jobs were entry-level jobs. It's not the case anymore. So when you look at sort of the average ages of people who are working for these low wages and receiving benefits, they're in their 30s, right? So it's just our economy has changed. In many cases, and maybe even to say in most cases, these are not jobs for teenagers or people just getting out of school. These are jobs that people are working to try to support their families, and it's really the only options that are available to them.
One last follow-up, and I'll be done.
I'm going to try to move on and go ahead.
I guess you hit on something that I was kind of getting at there is, shouldn't this be a study to look at why we're running the high-wage jobs out of the state? So because pulp and paper used to pay, I mean, my guys made $70 an hour with benefits, $75 an hour with benefits. A lot of those jobs we've lost, so shouldn't this be a study of looking how we bring back some of those major industrial players that actually are doing high-tech jobs that are paying well? And wouldn't that make more sense than singling out businesses and making it hard for them to do business here?
Chair Holley, Representative Widener. I think you touched on a couple of really interesting points here. First, Oregon's economy overall has been growing very fast, about three times as fast as the U.S. economy. That's largely, you can attribute most of that growth to the high-tech sector. Unfortunately, the increase in profits in that sector has not corresponded to an increase in the number of jobs. So even though there are, by and large, that sector does pay good wages, high-wage jobs, sort of the number of those high-wage jobs has actually been pretty flat over the last few years. When you talk about the sort of the erosion and the disappearance of good sort of middle-wage jobs, that's something that we're really seeing around the country as really large big corporations have just outsourced millions of jobs to other countries. I guess just the other day I was in Astoria and just saw the around the shipyards of how many sort of logs were being piled up for export. Just sort of raw logs that you'd think, it would be great to see those processed, here in Oregon, where people could, Oregonians could get some work doing that. I think they're, I'm really eager to hear solutions to try to encourage those, this kind of business in the state and so forth. I think it's kind of a separate issue from what. It's separate from what House Bill 3471 is really addressing. Certainly I think it's another an important kind of avenue for exploration and for policy efforts. So
I'm dying to ask a question myself. The purpose of this bill, I think is admirable when you're looking at trying to reduce the burden that taxpayers have to pay to help people get by, especially in the case when they're working full time, and so it gets back to that living wage issue. And commenting on Representative Barreto's thoughts that this is sort of a back end way of addressing that issue. At what wage level do you see the public benefit or the employees having to rely on public assistance go away? That would be the front-end way of addressing them, just saying, okay, let's raise the wages so people don't have to rely on public assistance, to rely on taxpayers to subsidize their ability to make a living and to have food on the table, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Chair Holby, that's an excellent question, and it's a difficult one to answer. Certainly, current proposals to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour would help a lot of people, a lot of working families, kind of earn enough to support themselves without safety net assistance programs. when you actually kind of dive in, you know, because the eligibility for programs are based on, you know, family size and so for how many people are working in the family and so forth, it's hard to pin a single number on like what's that magic number that's going to kind of solve all our problems.
Well, if you were to take the average family size for the average worker, you know, is $15 an hour that number, or
it's probably much higher than that actually.
Rip Simonos.
I would just offer a comment that when I tried to look into who's getting food stamps, and the reason we only have data back from 2007 is because that was the last time the agency that is able to collect this actually the agency that's providing food stamps does not track your actual employer. They track the type of work you do, but they don't track the employer. And we'd have to pass legislation to actually get them to do that. And I think there have been attempts by various legislators that were here prior to my term trying to do that. But the topic was very hot politically for this very reason, because it might expose what's going on in this situation, what the report is trying to get at. So that's the reason why we only have data going back to 2007. That was the last time it was tracked and aggregated. It would be very interesting to require the Department of Human Services to actually track the employer. We could get a much clearer picture of what's going on. And I would just say, I think their idea is intriguing, because what it'd be nice if maybe the Walmart lobbyist or the McDonald's folks would get up here and explain that, no, this isn't really their business model. They're not really relying on public subsidies to be able to do, you know, to put their business and their goods out in the world. Just sort of an accident. I'm curious if that's what they would say if they were here on the stand.
Sure.
Representative Barreto.
Yeah, actually, Representative Nose brings up some good things. So I was wondering, when you talk about public assistance, would that include earned income tax credit, school grants, energy assistance, housing allowances? What do you look at when you say assistance from the government? How much does that include?
So, Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, the $1.7 billion figure just includes SNAP, medical assistance programs, and employment-related daycare. And the reason why, and really for practical reasons, because those are the programs that are tracked by the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority in their data system, and that they publish statistics on the concurrent use of those programs. So those are the ones that were sort of the easiest to tally up. So they don't include housing. So that estimate does not include housing subsidy. It does not include earned income tax credit. It does not include other types of assistance programs. So that's why, in my view, that number is actually quite low. It's a conservative estimate.
Other questions for this panel? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A question.
This is a question. So the programs that you named, most of those are pretty heavily federal programs. So like 3-to-1 federal dollars to state dollars, is that correct?
Well, it depends on the program, but that's probably low, actually.
Not seeing any other questions for you right now. I appreciate you coming forward and giving us your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Up next, Betsy Earls and Bill Perry.
Yeah, she was in the room. I want to send you this report.
Katie Fast. Katie Fast.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. Should I start? Members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. I think Katie Fast is just down in revenue and she's on her way. AOI is appearing before you today in opposition to House Bill 3471 and House Bill 2090, but I will direct most of my comments at 3471.
Thanks, Paul.
We can talk about 2090 later if you would like to. House Bill 3471, as you've heard, requires that employers with more than 250 employees pay a tax of 50 cents an hour work by each employee making less than $11 an hour, 120% of minimum wage. And the stated purpose of this tax is to compensate the state for public assistance that it will have to provide to each employee making in the range of $11 or $12 an hour. Excuse me. But this binary view that low wages equal automatically a heavy use of public services misses a broader and very important point about the relationship between large employers and their workers and the communities where they both live and work. All employers, in one way or another, are part of their communities and support their communities in multiple ways. The most obvious is providing jobs and by paying property and income taxes and other fees associated with the type of business that they are. Those property and income taxes go into providing, in part, public services, such as the ones that have been described by the proponents of the bill earlier in this hearing. A less obvious and less uniform way that large employers contribute to their communities is through the charitable work of their employees and corporations. Some of this is driven by corporations that have a public policy of charitable work. Others are driven at the employee level through United Way and others, such as the Home Depot program that provides housing, doesn't provide housing, cleans up and maintains veterans' houses every year in November in different communities around the country. I would just point out that retail is obviously one of the industries that would be very clearly impacted by the bill, yet retail jobs paying in the range of $11 or $12 an hour play a very, very important role in the state economy. These are the jobs where people start. They are people's first jobs, and where they start to gain important skills and experience. They start careers in management, finance, logistics, and loss prevention, just to name a few. To imply that jobs such as this are a drag on the state's economy and on public services really is to ignore all the good things that such jobs provide. And employees in these jobs are overwhelmingly aware that these are jobs where you start. In a 2013 study conducted by the Associated Press and the National Opinion Research Center for Public Affairs Research, 72% of employees working for large employers saw a great deal of opportunity for career advancement for low-wage workers compared to 58% for employees of smaller firms. And 91% of large employers on that same study reported that they have a budget for training lower-wage workers. House Bill 3471 is the kind of bill that would impact benefits that employers pay and offer to employees in lower-wage jobs, starting jobs, places where people begin their careers. And could possibly hurt the workers that the bill is actually intended to benefit. So before you decide to advance bills such as House Bill 2090 or 3071, we ask that you recognize that there's a broader relationship that between employers, large employers, their employees, and the communities that they serve. And it's not just a one-way low-wage worker and drag on public services relationship. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association. And one just kind of technical thing in the bill I wanted to point out before I get into my comments is when you look at Section 5, the way I read that, it applies to all employers. The rest of the kind of sections towards the end just reference Section 4, which is the section that talks about 250 employees or more. So all the reporting and audits and everything else can apply to every employer as I read that, small or large. Now, kind of the principle of the bill, we're obviously opposed to 3471. I think obviously what they're trying to accomplish here, I think, is a goal that most people want to achieve. But when you look just from our industry standpoint, back when we had the minimum wage campaigns, when these things were on the ballot, just specifically in the restaurant industry, probably about half the minimum wage workers in the restaurant industry are tipped employees, and they're making $20 an hour. And so in many cases, you're going to be charging 50 cents an hour for employees that are making well over minimum wage, almost double minimum wage. The other thing in our industry, about 35% of our employees are teens or entering the workforce. Now, those aren't mutually exclusive, so some of those tipped employees are going to be minors. also, so where that mix is, I don't really know. But once again, if you're trying to get people living on minimum wage, a vast majority of our employees do not fall in that category, yet we're still going to be paying the penalty on those employees. And the other thing is, to kind of address Representative Noe's question in some of these, is remember our industry, the benefit of our industry is we can do a lot of short schedules and flexible schedules. And so what you get are a lot of college students mothers with kids that can find jobs that, you know, you can take a four-hour lunch shift and still be there when your kids get home from school. And so there are some benefits that our industries have, that the flexible and short schedules. Now, are those people going to be on public assistance? They probably will if they're working 4 hours in the afternoon. But it doesn't, you know, it's a lot of times it's just their way to earn income and still be there for their kids. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that play in into a lot of these jobs that are beneficial in these areas. But this bill is going to tax a lot of people. And to Representative Barreto's point, our business, like anybody else, is built on a profit margin. You can say a business gets so many dollars in the door, but anytime you raise the price, beef prices go up, labor prices go up, that profit margin is always going to relatively remain the same because there's risks involved with doing a business. So to associate it with profit margins, I don't think is a fair assessment. The other thing is, you know, they talk about business taxes being low in Oregon. Single sales factor, obviously, for a multi-state corporation is going to be a huge benefit for coming to Oregon. If you're a franchisee that's got five or six units basically just stated in Oregon, we've got one of the highest income taxes in the country. And so you hear business taxes are high or low, but it really depends on your business model. And a lot of the independent businesses that fully function in Oregon, they're going to have a higher tax rate than most other states. If you operate in multiple states, you're going to have a lower. It's just, to kind of make that statement, I don't think it's a fair assessment because every business is going to be taxed a little bit differently. But, you know, I understand what they're getting at, but they're going to, this net is going to catch a lot more people that are not on public assistance and potentially harm the ability for people to hire, you know, teenagers, get people into the workforce and do several different things. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good morning. For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau. First, on House Bill 3417, seems to be the intent of the bill to...
3471.
Oh, sorry. Imposed numbers.
Yes.
It seems to be the intent of the legislation to exempt out agricultural workers and seasonal workers. So I'm going to hold my comments for the task force legislation. You know, in agriculture, I don't think we would be considered a large employer, especially in the definitions of the fee bill. However, there are times of the year where a farm can hire up to 300 or more employees for a harvest for a month, a few weeks. And it's unclear in the study bill how those employers would be represented on the work group. And that is a concern that we have, is that when you're looking at only three large employees at the agricultural sector or other sectors that are unique like that would not be represented on the work group. Bill also referenced that in the restaurant industry, you have employers who are hiring folks who are part-time. In our sector, we hire folks for a short time of year. You know, on other times of the year, they might be on public assistance, but when they're coming onto the farm, they might be, you know, that may be the time that they're working, where they're not working in the fall or other times of the year. So I think it's making assumptions that it is the employer's burden, even if they're not a full-time worker in those industries. We also have concerns that the work group has a predetermined outcome that there will be a fee, and it's more about how you structure that fee. And if the bill moves forward, I think there should also be a discussion in there about how we can spur employment and job growth and job development. That seems to be a discussion that's lacking this year in the legislature, and something that we would like to bring forward and have a lot of discussions on how we grow small business and also large employment sectors as well. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Widener.
Everybody else is scared of the big bad business lobby. I'm not. So
don't impugn people.
So
speak to yourself, not other people.
To myself. I guess my question, because I'm sitting here thinking about where we're after, and this is something that's always kind of puzzled me a little bit, especially Bill and your industry, the restaurant industry, and a lot of the industries we're talking about, because I've been in all of them, worked in all of them. And I've always wondered why the state, why we tax people that are making under that. I mean, I'm looking at this, and I just kind of roughly did the numbers with $10 an hour. If they're making $10 an hour, they're paying an extra $150, $250 out of their check every month in state tax. You think if we did away with that, we could actually then look at reducing subsidies, or that would probably be more beneficial for employees than the direction we're going?
Chair Holvey's Representative Widener, I know there was a task force a while ago that talked about moving the taxable income up with poverty levels like the federal government does, but there's obviously a fiscal hit to that too, and so it was kind of off the table. Obviously that's something that I think we would, most business people support, is shouldn't be taxing people under the federal poverty level, but they get usually money back from different ways. But if I can add, this discussion on $15 an hour, if you move up, do you basically put people money in people's pockets? And I would fundamentally argue that that's not true, just from a standpoint of when $12 came out, I called my daycare provider and said, what does this do to you? And he said it would probably be about an 18% increase in daycare rates. Then called a couple of the restaurateurs in the area, just in my area, and it was about a 6%, 7% increase in costs. And so if I'm a mother with two kids, double my 18%, your every meal goes up 6%, she's probably not better off. If I'm a young 21-year-old, I get a pocket a lot of that money. So once again, most people that make minimum wage use services that are provided by other people that pay minimum wage workers, grocery stores, restaurants, daycare providers, all these different things. So, it's growing the economy helps all of us. Trying to inflate, in my words, the bottom is not necessarily going to help those bottom rung workers, and people like me that make above average, the $40,000 income may not see as much of a push point. But it's trying to get at that, I think, is something we all should be working on. I just don't think that this particularly gets at it from my perspective.
Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. I assume Heather Conroy still has not made it. Jeff Anderson. Good morning.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Anderson. I'm Secretary Treasury of United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555. We have 20,000 members, primarily in health and in retail industries. I just wanted to lend our union support to House Bill 3471. We believe because there's an income inequality, there is poverty, and poverty is growing, that there's an obligation for government to actually indeed be invested in trying to correct that. Some of the comments I heard earlier that kind of lead credence, how can we bring industrialization back? I don't know that we can. I grew up in the timber industry, 50,000 jobs left the Northwest in 250 mills over a 15-year span. Half the counties in Oregon were ONC counties. They've lost the ability to even provide basic government services in many rural counties. Paper mills in particular are probably more dramatically affected by the internet and email. And that has taken away a lot of U.S. Postal Service jobs as well. So there's a transformation in the economy, And the economy coming out of this 2008 recession is producing lower paid jobs. Today, the average Oregonian is making $1,100 less per person on a per capita basis across the state of Oregon over the last 10 years. So there really is a need to do something. My industry, the retail industry, service sector, has seen the biggest explosion in growth of employment, but not in wages. We've seen it in profits, but not in wages. Wages is what's producing second, third, tertiary employment. High-wage jobs in a community provided the retail service sector employment, and now in many communities, we're seeing our jobs as coveted as the industrial jobs that have been lost. So the idea, and everybody kind of brought up Walmart, I'll take on Walmart. Walmart is, from my perspective, a predator that plays on the federal tax dollar, the state tax dollar. They have no compunction about it. And we know from that 2007 survey that our union requested legislation to make it transparent who's using the Oregon Medical Plan, the Oregon Health Plan. We know from that Walmart was the number one employer on that list. We know in 14 states where that information is transparent, 13 of them were Walmart was the number one employer. They use more tools to reduce their obligations of paying taxes very creatively. And I can provide information on how they do that. But I guess, you know, if I had a retail industry in the food service sector and I had a 3% net profit, that's a gangbuster year for this industry. I mean, if Kroger, Safeway, Albertsons, or Super Value, any of them had 3.5%, the value of that stock would grow substantially, because we've been a high-volume, low-profit industry that's worked on 1 to 2% as an industry. So when I'm hearing they're 3.5%, I'm going, there's the money to be able to afford to pay their employees. The average wage by their own financial person says over half their employees make more than $10 an hour of a million Americans working for Walmart in the United States. Put another way, half a million Americans do not get paid more than $10 an hour working at Walmart. That's their own financial or their own communication expert providing that statement. He provided that half of them make $10 or more. He didn't provide the obvious fact that the other half are down. Yeah, I've been in the retail industry 43 years, and my experience in the retail stores that we represent, about 40% of the employees are career path. They're not all churn going to move on. Frankly, I was one of those that came out of high school and thought, this is temporary, why I went to college. Next thing you know, I'm still there. A lot of people are still there that also thought that was transitional. Today, it's even more so. We've seen the turnover that was typical in the 70s and 80s and the 90s come to a roaring halt as people want to stay to maintain that they have pensions, they have health insurance. The downward pressure of Walmart has become what one grocery executive told me is a unique model that he admired. He admired the fact that the company could grow at such a great rate on a low wage base, but also in the same breath said, it's probably not right for society. Now, I admire this person. He's now retired from the company he represented. But he was straightforward and honest. And there's a point where we have to say we represent Oregonians. That's the mission to hear. And most of the profits of a Walmart, for every store they open in a rural community, they eliminate 300 jobs that they produce 200. And then they're paying less on those jobs. So, frankly, if there's something that can recover the taxpayer obligation, I think it's an obligation that we do that. If this is one way of doing it, great. If there's other ways of doing it, fantastic. But we have to be able to have a society that people can work and make a living on. And that's not what's happening today. The income disparity is just rampant, and we need solutions. This is but a milestone toward that. So a lot of red meat, my apologies.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You represent the retail and grocery outlet, is that correct?
Correct.
So what is the typical pay in that industry, you know, for the smaller retailers? You know, I mean, that Walmart would have replaced, and some of them still remain, but what's the typical pay in there?
I would, please. Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, if I looked at the first Walmart that came into Oregon, it was in the city of Lebanon. It wiped out a lot of the small little businesses, the bookstore, the floral shop, a sporting goods store, who happened to be a relative of mine. And a lot of those jobs paid with the owners and stuff much more than what the company's paying. That if you look at a grocery store model, in 1985, Walmart, to my knowledge, they were just going into the food sales. Today, they're 15% of the national market. If you put that in perspective, Safeway corporate-wide in the United States was about 7.5%, 8% of the market. So in the span of since 1985, they grew a base where they become the largest purveyor of groceries. When we looked at the wage base in the city of Eugene, out on the West 11th store, we did a comparison of the cost that our employers are paying in health insurance, they were paying in pension, they were paying in wages. There was about a 40% differential on the average worker working in that Walmart that was not getting that. And the irony is that OPB did a story a number of years ago that showed that Walmart was actually telling people when they hired them to sign on, here's your I-9, here's your W-2, and here's the Oregon Health Plan application. So their model was to actually use government services in lieu of. In fact, they've announced that they're discontinuing health insurance on part-time workers, of which make up about 60% plus of their employment.
Representative.
I'll follow up on that.
Yeah, go ahead. One more.
As far as the healthcare workers, if these are available, and I'm not making the argument, I'm just asking you, Jeff, if this is made available by the state for people to take advantage of this, you know, is this? I'm asking, is it wrong that if you're making a certain level of income, that you would naturally sign on with the state for any other benefit that you may be able to get from the state?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I don't begrudge anybody seeking making a living and providing for their family. That's my whole point. A company that is so profitable that doesn't provide the basis for a local community to make a standard of living is failing that community. They might say that they're part of the community, but the reality is Walmart, as that example, takes that money out of the community. It doesn't stay in and circulate. Those profits are gone. I think you have to have what is society's norms? What do we expect as a standard of our of employers working in having the opportunity? Because I also think it's a privilege to in our free society to have the opportunity to build a business and grow it. But you should be contributing back to the community and whatever those community standards are. And I would submit that a substandard should not be our standard. So if somebody's in poverty and they're only creating poverty wage jobs, and yet that company's profitable, the question is, are they being a good citizen? And I would suggest no. So I don't begrudge people seeking assistance individually. I begrudge a capital interest for profit, saying, I'm going to avoid my community obligations, if that is, and have everybody go to the government to get assistance. So the model, I feel, is not a sustainable one for government because it's government subsidizing corporations.
Thank you. I appreciate
If
I could, I'd
Representative
a little different request. I see Bully is in the audience, and something that would be immensely helpful to me would be if we could get an estimate of how much revenue this 50-cent fee would generate. And then the second one is, since Bully's in charge of this, I'd like to have a definition and a number for employers that would be impacted. 250 employees. I want to know, is McDonald's, that's independently owned, but a franchise, is McDonald's one of those companies? And how does that go down the line, and how many companies would there be? So if we could, I think that would be helpful to understand what this really does and give us a better view.
Yeah. And I think the employment department would be a perhaps able.
Well, and that might be a better choice. I don't know. I just, as I understand it, Boldy is to be the administrator, and that's the reason I was
and perhaps,
choosing.
You know, perhaps we can, I don't think we're going to answer that question
not today,
in this
I
committee.
Don't think.
Today, so okay. we can try to seek some of those answers later on. I appreciate your testimony, Jeff, and I know it's a big issue out there that some employers in your industry do pay the higher wage and their workers don't receive the assistance, and so it does create sort of an unlevel playing field out there. So. I appreciate your comments. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2090 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3471. And with that, let me move on.
I texted Hayden.
Okay. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3325. Jan, can you give us a brief description of House Bill 3325?
I will, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm just going to point you to the proposed -1 amendment, since that replaces the original make. It allows employers to deduct health care benefits from the minimum wage paid to employees as long as the deduction does not result in a wage that is lower than 150% of the federal minimum wage.
Thank you. Representative Hayden, good morning.
Morning.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record and perhaps describe your -1 amendment to this bill.
Thank you very much, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden. I'm state representative from House District 7. I want to again thank you for the opportunity to come before you and clarify my intentions on House Bill 3325, which is not properly represented in the printed draft before you. I have provided you with a printed amendment and some additional information, including this introduction letter. As a result, I have the -1 amendment to present to you today, which does accurately portray my goals and intentions. The brief explanation of the current language of House Bill 3325 is due to running out of time, running against the filing deadline, filing this legislation, and not taking the adequate time to properly review the draft. I made a mistake, the kind of mistake I won't make twice, hopefully. Please allow me to speak to the -1 amendment before you to clarify my intentions and define this bill. Today, I am here to start a conversation about compensation packages versus W-2 wages. This bill is not about increasing or decreasing Oregon's minimum wage. It is about the cause and effect of any significant change in Oregon's minimum wage, currently at 127% of the Federal Fair Labor Standard Act. House Bill 2325, if amended, would only be triggered if the minimum wage would rise above 150%, or about a 12% increase, to $10.87 per hour above the 150% of the Federal Fair Labor Standard Act, which would be equivalent to $10.87. You can refer to page 2. And the reason for the bill that I've provided you that equates federal poverty levels to people that are qualified for Oregon Health Plan or health care benefits and the incomes that they can have and still qualify. This was the intent of the bill. currently a single person working full-time at Oregon's minimum wage, or $9.25, does not qualify for Oregon health benefit coverage. However, a single parent with one child will qualify up to $21,700 a year, or about $10.50 an hour. A single parent making $10.87, or 150% of the Federal Fair Labor Standard Act, will no longer qualify for health care benefits. This is the trigger level of House Bill 3325. A single parent with two children making $13.50 an hour, or $28,080 a year, will no longer qualify for health care benefits either. This is known as the health care cliff. These estimates do not include individual tax filers' unique situations. That's a disclosure. I realize this issue is complex, but the bottom line is that the unintended consequences resulting in law can be fixed, thereby helping an important part of our population who needs the critical services that our state or employers provide. This bill is about giving low-wage earners the opportunity to retain health care benefits, or at least have a better chance of receiving them through their employer when they fall off the health care benefit cliff. Thank you for your time. I hope to have your support helping low-wage working families have better access to health care benefits.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony and bringing your bill forward. Representative Doherty.
Well, I just have a question as to how this actually works. So, and I did read the first one, I did read the amendment.
Thank you.
And so is this the sort of situation, if I am an employee that makes, maybe right now, $11.50 an hour, and I get some medical benefits and I get some sick leave, does this mean that whatever the value of that is will be taken away from my hourly wage? Is that how I read it, or am I reading it wrong?
For your example, this bill, as amended, would only address the health care benefit. It wouldn't have anything to do with a retirement plan or a sick leave. And it would only be triggered in the event that the minimum wage in Oregon would be raised above the $11 example that you're talking about. And here our trigger is $10.87. So current minimum wage is $9.25. If current minimum wage went to $15 an hour, for example, employers would then be allowed to deduct from $10.87 the health and above a health care premium that they help pay for, because those employees, when they get to $10.87, have a high risk of losing their state coverage on their health benefits, because if they're working full-time, because of the wage that they're now making. So it would give the option to the employer above $10.87 per hour, or basically $11 an hour, that gap to deduct health care benefits only.
From the employee's paycheck.
From the employee's paycheck.
Okay,
yes.
So I could go below minimum wage, because sometimes it could be maybe $5 or $6 an hour for health benefits.
No, this bill is designed to where you could not go below the minimum wage, which is currently 127% of the Federal Fair Labor Act.
But I could be bringing home less money on my paycheck.
Than you are now. This bill is designed, if the minimum wage increases significantly, it's designed to help keep the health care benefit for them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Questions? So, Representative Hayden, looking at this bill, it's an intriguing, I guess, policy discussion. That it seems like you're moving towards a compensation definition that would include benefits that are paid as part of the compensation. And if you take that out a little bit further, that total compensation, which would include health benefits and retirement potentially down the road, could be established as the wage level that we should be considering, and not the actual current standard that we have of the minimum wage. So what you're saying, if I'm carrying that out, am I missing something here? It seems like you're kind of combining total compensation as a consideration that we should be making in establishing minimum wage conversations.
I believe that, Chair Holvey, I believe that is a correct explanation. And again, this is a little bit of a complex issue. I have a construction company that deals with state and federal contracts, and so this is actually modeled after a program that we utilize under the prevailing wage requirements on federal contracts. They have something called a fringe benefit amount that is very complex. I've tried to make this only in kind of my area, in my wheelhouse of health care. But to your point, fringe benefits are counted towards that prevailing wage. So companies can provide a set, you know, amount of W-2 wage and then have a smorgasbord, if you will, of benefits that they can add into that to compensate that employee. So the idea behind this bill is if minimum wage were to rise above essentially $11 an hour, which would disenfranchise many employers, low-wage earners, from their health care benefit at the state level, give them an opportunity to try and keep that with the employer level.
So to follow up on that, I think in that prevailing wage sense, those fringe benefits are required, and so therefore they're considered as part of the compensation package. In this proposal, it seems like it's more of an option. It's if you do this. So it's not like you're requiring all employers to provide health care, so that we could establish health care as part of that compensation or wage requirement. And so it's sort of like you've got apples and oranges a little bit in that. I'm still trying to think of how that plays out.
Correct. It is really aimed more towards your small employers with the ACA or the Affordable Care Act. There's a little different regulations for employers under 50 employees, which in 2017 will be raised to under 100 employees. So it is a complex bill when you really start looking at it and trying to figure that out. But if the minimum wage required increases, the employee would be required to be benefited that amount, but for the companies that are willing to provide, for the small employers that are willing to provide health care benefits, they would get a credit for that package of health care benefit, hopefully to stimulate the small employers that may not be providing health care benefits to be incentivized to provide that benefit, because it would be easier on the employer to access health care there than to try and go through the exchange.
Right. Would it be fair to say that you're sort of creating a parallel minimum wage for employers that provide health care as opposed to those that don't? And so it seems like you would have two different wage requirements.
Well,
two different standards for minimum wage anyway.
Chair Holvey, I can understand that perspective, but the amount of compensation for both of those employers would be equal based on a compensation calculation of a package. Mm-hmm. And this benefit only deals with health care.
Right. That's interesting. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually kind of think this gets after what we just heard in House Bill 3471 in reducing the dependency on benefits from the government and everything. So I'm just kind of thinking, without going after the minimum wage piece here, and I don't know if you've done this yet, Representative Hayden, but just looked at maybe even addressing it more in part of their salary or compensation where it's fully deductible as a benefit for the employee. So we keep the minimum wage at a level, but we're encouraging employers to go out and put insurance on their employees or getting them on one of the any sort of health plan that's out there, so we're not picking them up on Medicaid. Have you looked at or investigated anything like that, so to incentivize businesses to put health care on their employees?
Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, yes. And part of this bill, it is actually an increased benefit if it can get through the Oregon Department of Revenue. The intent is for an employer that let's say their wage is $13 an hour, or their minimum wage has moved to $13 an hour, if they provide a health care benefit in that for the employee, let's say that's worth $1.50 an hour, that $1.50 an hour, they would not have to pay, if it's structured correctly, any tax from their W-2. So it would be a non-tax benefit to them. So in actuality, they actually get a little higher compensation than if they have to pay taxes on the full $13 an hour.
Perfect.
Wow. Thank you. You certainly brought us a bill that will make us think a little bit. So I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I'd like to call up next Betsy Earls and Bill Perry. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. So basically, we're here in support of this bill. And with this, I'm going to give you what I assume are a couple of assumptions. And I think you guys that might be more knowledgeable in the healthcare arena than I am, and certain. But the trends that we're starting to see, in my opinion, are business plans under the ACA seem to be getting a little bit more expensive. The rate of increase is going higher, where the rate increase of personal plans doesn't seem to be growing as much. So I think keeping small business plans is going to be very difficult in the future if the trend continues. And in the previous bill, I had talked about what I see as the most disruption in minimum wage increases seems to happen at the low-wage worker level, because employers are always left with that decision of, you know, do I raise prices, do I cut hours, and a lot of different things. So the one thing that I think this bill helps with is reduce some of that disruption in that workforce as minimum wage increases. So people start to reduce the chance of losing their health care coverage in exchange for the wage increase, and it gives the employers some different options, so they might not have to raise prices as much at the services that increase for lower wage workers. So, you know, I personally, the other assumption is I don't think you'll be able to keep somebody below minimum wage for very long. So what I think this bill does is, in that transition, really smooths it out for a lot of smaller employers. So I think it will be helpful in trying to reduce some of what I might term damage that occurs when you get more of a drastic minimum wage increase. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing in support of House Bill 3325 and most specifically the -1 amendments. And it's our understanding, and I think Representative Hayden reiterated, that those amendments are only triggered when the minimum wage rises above 150% of the federal minimum wage. And I think House Bill 3325, with the amendments, addresses a really, really important aspect of the low-wage conversation that we started having earlier on today. And that is what happens when a worker starts to make more than their wage rises above what would make them eligible for public benefits, and most particularly health insurance. Health insurance is and will remain one of the highest costs and most important decisions that an employer can make in employing a workforce. And they do not want to lose good workers because they are rising above the eligibility for benefits that the public assistance plan can provide them. So this provides an opportunity to keep good workers, longtime workers, on and provide them with health insurance that they might have been able to access a different way when their wages were a little bit lower. And again, smooths out that transition as they bump up over the benefits cliff that exists today. So I would just leave it at that and tell you we support the bill and appreciate Representative Hayden's bringing it forward, providing a different way to look at low-wage worker benefits.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Representative Widener, do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair. I actually, after Representative Hayden's testimony, everything, have fallen in love with this concept of one of the members on the healthcare committee. And I'm glad to see you guys are up here supporting this, because this is something that can really help small business in making decisions on putting forward health plans for their employees that they normally can't afford, because it's something that we've battled with only 3 employees and having to provide that. Just wondering, to me, the trigger I like where it's at, but I think I would almost like to see that benefit a little bigger, where we gave businesses a little more. Do you think it might be a little narrow, because we're looking at about $3 an hour that we have to play with for benefit for that employee? I'm almost wondering if it shouldn't be more like $5 to $6. So just looking at the triggers, if I'm understanding this right, where it's at, because one of the things I'd like to be able to do is see employers be able to contract with doctors directly for seeing their patient or their employees. So I have 3 employees. I can go to the doctor across the street, and part of their benefit packages, they get all them and their family can be seen by that doctor. I see Representative Hayden standing up back there, but as an employer or members, you probably haven't got a chance to check with them, but is that enough room, do you think, for your small employers out there and large employers for the benefit, or do you think we should open that up a little more?
Oh, Representative Widener, Chair Holvey, I mean, without knowing what the minimum wage increase is going to be, you know, whether or not that's a good number, it's really hard to tell. I mean, obviously, from a business perspective, anything that increases my management tools to try to manage increases in the business is going to be more helpful. You know, some of this is probably going to be based on political realities, is what has a chance of getting through the building. So, you know, like I said, I respect the work that Representative Hayden's done at this point. He's trying to get a package that at least gets the discussion started, and I'm happy with whichever way that he feels it's best to move. But obviously, the more tools I have to manage with, the better off I'm going to be able to manage the business, because every minimum wage is going to impact each one of our businesses differently. And so to say there's one factor that's going to help, you know, everybody equally is probably not an accurate statement. Everybody's going to be a little bit different.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think it's always a balance between what the worker is making in increased minimum wage, what the employer can afford to pay for benefits, and this is a great place to start.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Up next, I have Kate Newall, Bonnie Allen Saylor, and Matt Swanson.
Chair Holvey, members of the Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall, representing Family Forward. It probably is no surprise to you that Family Forward is here today to oppose House Bill 3325. We see this as rolling back the minimum wage, and generally are opposed to every effort to roll back minimum wage protections for low-income Oregonians. We believe that 3325 does nothing to lift families out of poverty and only weakens their economic security. Minimum wage is a far cry from a living wage. I think also it's a fallacy to think that minimum wage earners are predominantly high school students or college students. There are a lot of families living on minimum wage, and it's $19,240 a year if that worker works every single day, 5 days a week. This is nowhere near sufficient to support a family. It's not enough to put food on the table, to keep a roof over your head, or to pay for quality childcare for your children. These are real expenses that low-income working families struggle with every day. Employees earning minimum wage need every dollar in their paycheck and are often not able to make ends meet even with this. And that's evidenced by the number of minimum wage earners who are on public assistance programs. I don't think that 3325 does anything to incentivize businesses to keep or maintain health insurance. And I think it's more important that those minimum wage earners, whatever the minimum wage should keep every dollar in their pocket. So in closing, Family Forward opposes 3325. And we believe that we should be looking for ways to increase the minimum wage, not decrease it or weaken it. And we urge you to oppose House Bill 3325.
Vice Chair Barton, members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Allen Saylor. I'm a staff attorney with the Northwest Workers Justice Project, which provides legal support and advocacy for workers and their organizations. We are also here to oppose House Bill 3325, including the amendments, though I only saw them this morning, so I'm not as familiar with the amendment. And we appreciate Representative Hayden's intent, if it is to address the benefits cliff issue, but I don't believe that this bill does that. I think it does something much more and much more concerning. I think, as Kate said, it really amounts to a cut in the minimum wage. While having that trigger is nice that it wouldn't kick in until the minimum wage goes up, when we talk about raising the minimum wage, we're talking about doing it with an acknowledgement that the current minimum wage is not enough. As Kate already addressed, it's not enough to raise a family on. You know, Oregon workers and families are really struggling to make ends meet. And so to take this bill, which we think amounts to a step backwards, where Oregon families need to be talking about a step forward. We also have real concerns on a practical level, with how the bill would work. We think it would make low-wage workers even more vulnerable to abuse, opening the door to wage theft, disguised as permissive deduction under this bill. The prevailing wage and fringe benefits has already come up at this hearing, and we see a ton of wage theft in that area. You know, Representative Hayden referred to how complex the fringe benefits regulations are, and that's true not only for employers but for the workers. And so to have workers in a position where it's much harder for them to see whether they've been paid the amount which they are owed, we think is problematic. So I think that's all I have. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair Barton, promotion there. My name is Matt Swanson. I represent the Service Employees International Union, Oregon State Council. I think that my colleagues to the right here have already addressed some of the major issues we had with the bill. I do want to spend a little more time with the amendments to get a sense of what the representative is going for here. To us, our read was that they're deducting from minimum wage health benefits, and I think that could lead to some pretty disastrous economic impacts for low-income families when you think of, at least in our read of the bill, what that would mean. I mean, these are people who are making very marginal income, and it appears that this would be a loss in income. But as I think the representative addressed with the dash four, there may be some complexities that we would look into. But our concern is that this may not be the best approach to actually expanding health care. And again, we'll spend a little more time looking at the dash fours, but it was our initial concern was really addressed with the bill as introduced. So thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. With that, I don't see any questions. I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3325 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3495.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure provides for the employer and employee contributions to a pension program and individual account program of OPSERP, that's the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, to first be made for new members for wages attributed to services performed for the first full pay period following the six-month probationary period without regard to when wages are considered earned for other purposes. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. Could we have Rob Bovette, Steve Rodeman, and Bob Livingston?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I know the time is waning, so I'll be brief. For the record, Rob Bovette, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. House Bill 3495 is a technical fix to some of the PERS statutes. As you're probably aware, there are three tiers of PERS benefits, Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP. OPSERP is what we're currently operating under. The problem this bill seeks to correct is an ambiguity in the contribution start date language in the OPSERP statute. What this has led to over the past decade is various directives and advice from PERS to various public employers that are either operating under what is known as paid when paid or paid when earned. The PERS auditors caught this and said, you really need to clean this up, but it really needs to be cleaned up in statute. House Bill 3495 does that and would treat all three tiers in the same fashion. What this bill does not address is retroactivity. It does not impact at all anybody who's in OPSERP right now, but this bill would be important to helping potentially the PERS board resolve that issue and help us avoid any litigation over the interpretation of this very ambiguous statute. So we strongly urge you to pass House Bill 3495 and help us fix this technical glitch, create efficiencies, and avoid litigation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Steve Rodman. I'm the executive director with PERS. We've submitted some written testimony to explain the provisions of the bill and the situation that the AOC's legislation seeks to correct. So I'm just here to answer any questions there are about the implementation.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm also a member of the PERS Coalition. As Mr. Bovet has explained, this is largely a technical fix. I think my point of testifying today is to remind this committee and this legislative body that this is a consequence of what happens when you continue to change pension programs. It's been 10 years. This is now at no fault to PERS, no fault to employers, no fault to members, a technicality that needed to be corrected and addressed in statutes, but yet it's been 10 years since we implemented OPSERP. And so my point to that is that as a member of the system and as somebody that advocates for retirement security, changes to systems are all largely technical, but they also can be impactful. And just as an example, there are additional small issues of fairness and inequality that continue to reap their head 10 years later that do have consequences for employers and members of the system. And so this is a bill that does need to be addressed and carried forward. But I just wanted to take this opportunity to remind folks that retirement security is an important issue that you've vetted previously, and that changes and major changes to pension systems are complicated and do have consequences. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. So I guess I have a question for the PERS person, Mr. Rodman. Has the lack of, I guess, this clarity and this ambiguity impacted PERS recipients?
Chair Holvey, the answer is yes, in the sense that there have not been contributions made on behalf of members just for their initial start into the program that should have been made under the laws that's currently written. So, as Mr. Bovet said, we have some cleanup to do, and this bill doesn't affect that cleanup. It just sets a course going forward that hopefully will be easier to understand and comply with.
So I would assume that this particular bill passed cleans that up so that the PERS members would be getting credit for that first initial month, I guess, or first time period going into their PERS benefit, whereas before perhaps some of the public employers did not put that amount in for that first time period?
Chair Holvey, that is part of the cleanup. That's what we would be doing, is going back and working with employers to figure out which contributions should have been made, the earnings that should have been attributed to that, and paying those either into accounts for individuals still in the system or paying it out to members who have left the system.
So just real briefly, this fixes the problem going forward. Is it your intent to try to make whole the PERS recipients or employees going retroactive, but this bill doesn't necessarily address that?
That's correct.
Retroactive piece?
That's correct. It doesn't address it. That's going to happen regardless of whether this legislation goes in?
And so, okay. So, Chair Holvey, but this legislation does provide what I would call the first domino, in the sense that we get the clarification moving forward, and it creates an additional argument for us to essentially tell the PERS board, we think you ought to cover these additional expenses through the employer contingency fund, and therefore we don't have to litigate any of these issues about this ambiguous statute. And in that way we can avoid costs, litigation, solve the problem going forward and retroactively just through the piece of legislation.
Right. So it's going to have a beneficial impact to the PERS employees that to make sure that they got credit for that first time period of pay, essentially.
And Mr. Chair, eventually, if this legislation passes and the PERS board does what we hope they'll do, that would be the case. Everybody would be treated equally. Right now, historically looking back, they weren't treated equally, depending upon the various advice given.
Yeah, I guess my only concern is that we're not in this legislation. We're not directing anybody to make these employees whole, and that was the intent to do that. We're just assuming you're going to do that, and if you don't, then we're going to have to come back and address that. So, I mean, that's the only part of this bill that makes me a little bit nervous, is there is not a direction to fix this retroactively.
And Mr. Chair, that is correct. I have level of confidence that we can resolve that administratively. If we don't, we'll be back with one or two things. Either there will be litigation or further legislation, but I think that further legislation is unnecessary right now. I think we can resolve this.
And I think the implementation of the law as written has been relatively uneven over this 10 years. Some employers have complied and others have not in different ways and at different times. So I would urge you not to direct us to do a retroactive solution, only because writing that would be more difficult than the administrative process that Mr. Bovet mentioned that we're already in the process of implementing.
And Mr. Chair, I would echo that 100%. I think if we tried to address that in this legislation, we would create more problems than the potential solution.
Thanks. I'll try to understand that later.
Me too.
I think it's pretty clear. We'd like to move on. We got one more piece of business to do.
I'm good. I was just kind of wondering how many people this affected. But
yeah, well, if it affects 1 or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, it's important to fix. So thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3495. And open a work session on House Bill 3059.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure about live entertainers. It directs Boley to publish a poster regarding the rights of independent contractors and employees who perform live entertainment. And it directs Boley to operate a toll-free hotline to receive inquiries and complaints from live entertainment employees. There is a proposed -2 amendment that specifies that the hotline can be staffed by persons who have a background in the operation of a crisis line. It provides a clear definition of live entertainment and what a live entertainment facility is, and allows a hotline caller to remain anonymous or to request that the inquiry or complaint remain confidential. There's no revenue impact on the -2 amendment. There is a fiscal statement on the -2 amendment that's been posted to OLIS. And it's been requested that the committee add a referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. I think adopting the -2 amendment first, Representative Barton.
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 3059.
Representative Barton moves to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 3059. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the -2 amendments adopted.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 3059 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 3059 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Matthew, can we have a vote?
Representative McGrath?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Baskerville?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Excused.
Representative Fagan.
Excused.
Representative Hurd.
Excused.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
President Blatner?
Yes.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnaman?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3059, having received the votes, is passed. No other business before us. We will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.